Hi, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com. Find my work on Yahoo Sports' Devil Ball Golf Blog at sports.yahoo.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy. You can follow Golf News Net on Twitter and Facebook, twitter.com and facebook.com/golfnewsnet. If you're a subscriber to this show through iTunes or another podcasting service, including Stitcher and Spreaker, as well as our new audio partners, Audio Boom, thanks so much for doing so. Please be sure to check out Golf News Net Radio, a 24/7 stream of golf talk available on our website, golfnewsnet.com, as well on the TuneIn Radio app and on demand on audioboom.com. So in this week's show, we obviously should be talking about the greatest Players' Championship in its 40-year existence, and that's what we're going to talk about for much of this program and things related to Ricky Fowler. If you didn't get enjoyment out of watching what unfolded, what was really a slow burn on Sunday for the Players' Championship, I can't help you. You should just give up watching golf, because that is golf at its finest. For Ricky Fowler to have played those final six holes the way that he did in regulation at six under par, and really I don't think it had dawned on anybody yet what Fowler had accomplished until he really played the last three holes in four under par. And I think the shot on 16, the second shot from not the optimal lie, that stayed dry, it could have careened right into the water hazard, which would have brought easily six into play and would have ended his championship hopes outright. It could have bounced straight and then into the water. It could have just stopped, but it bounces left and kicks to within gimme range, inside the leather for sure, makes eagle, and then he just blitzes 17 and 18. I mean, if there is one person that truly loves and truly thrives on the par 3 17th at TPC Sawgrass, it is Ricky Fowler. And if you look at his record and his scorecards over the years at this tournament, and as he's standing on 17T, I'm thinking about 2012, the last time I covered that tournament in person and did it for Golf Channel. And I remember being out there for the final few holes trying to figure out who was going to win this thing, and Fowler was in it, so I was going to go see Fowler. And I'm standing there at the 17th hole, and I go to the tee box, and he hits a good shot and catch up with a few colleagues and get to the green, and you can just see and here, obviously, but you could just see the anticipation as Fowler was getting up there. And this is a different Ricky Fowler. He's 26 now. He's got more seasoning. He's got a new swing under Butch Harmon. But he still has the same short game, the same eye for playing golf and for big spots. And for whatever reason, he is very, very good at those match play type situations where it's do or die. And he did it. And he didn't have to make as long of a putt as he did in 2012 for that final round birdie. Got it even closer, 7-8 feet. But he mentioned afterward, when he had won, that he remembered the putt from 2012 a little bit that helped him on Sunday at TPC Sawgrass. And then, after hitting driver all week, he did the right thing and really decided that he wasn't going to change from the game plan. And he didn't. He and Joe Scovron did the right thing. They hit driver. Obviously, Ricky hit the driver, but they picked driver from the bag. And he hit it 330 yards on the 18th hole. 331 to be exact. That was the longest drive of the week at that hole. And he just carved it up. Hit a wedge from 115 into birdie range. Fortunately, got a good read off of Derek Fathauer. He had a putt slightly outside. He saw that it broke maybe a little bit more to the right than he initially thought. Drained it, the great reaction again, get 12 under par. And I think when he had posted that number, we all kind of figured that might just be good enough to get this thing done. And I say that because at the time, again, this is a slow burn. Fowler is all of a sudden injecting life into this tournament before the really final four or five groups get to these holes, 16, 17, and 18, the opportunity to post 12 or even 13 under, which had won the prior 4 years, to really have a chance to win. And fortunately, we got that. I think there was the initial celebration. All right, Fowler's going to win this thing. It's going to be so great. And then all of a sudden, it gets even better, because then you got Bill Haas and Ben Martin and Sergio Garcia and Kevin Kistner and others. Kevin Na, we even thought about briefly. Who can get to 12 and who might get to 13? And might this all work out again for the fifth consecutive year, where the 36-hole cut is at even par 144 and 13 under par, 275 wins the tournament. And it didn't work out that way, obviously. Garcia and Kisner go to the playoff, and I really liked the three-hole aggregate playoff. And I know for some people, they're going to object to it because they want the tournament to end sooner. They just want it to get over with. But I think the PGA Tour backed themselves into a corner by creating a sudden-death playoff system where the par 3 17th, which is a hole that is obviously subject to wind more than really any other hole in the golf course, they couldn't keep doing that. They could have moved it to 16. Obviously, that's not very friendly for fans. They could have moved it to 18, but then you kind of have the same result because there's just as easy of a possibility of a guy pulling his tee shot or pushing it if you're a lefty into the pond up the left side, and all of a sudden the tournament's over. There's no drama at all. So among the three holes, 16's your best option for in terms of drama and fairness, but otherwise it's a bad option. 17 is iconic, so you want that, but the crowd can still be pretty big, but they're not going to travel as far. And 18, the crowd's going to be there, but it's just dumb to have it compared to the 17th hole. So putting them all together in a three-hole aggregate was a great idea. I think it delivered on what it was supposed to be. More often than not, you get a winner out of the three-hole playoff. If you look at the three- and four-hole playoffs as a concept in the Open Championship and the PGA Championship, really there had only been one that went an extra hole, which was in 2002. You had the Open Championship at Muirfield. You had four guys in the playoff. Ernie Els and Thomas LeVay eventually went to that fourth hole, and Els won the Open Championship. So, yeah, I think that was kind of surprising that it went the additional hole, but it was one under, and even, so that's a pretty good stretch. Since they all parred 16 with terrible, nervous drives, that kind of set up that possibility of going another hole. And then for Fowler to birdie the 17th hole a third consecutive time on the day, that's incredible stones on a really tough golf hole, especially with all the marbles on the line. It's a $10 million purse, so you're playing for a $1.8 million first place check. And I know Ricky Fowler makes a boatload of money in endorsements and other stuff off the course, and he doesn't need money. But $2 million is $2 million to most anybody, unless you're a billionaire. And so it probably meant a lot to him, but I think it obviously meant even more to him to get the validation that he can win, that he can close, that he can seal the deal, that everything he was working on with Butch Harmon and the really subtle changes that he made in his full swing, that they worked and that they could stand to the test. And I think for Fowler, he was really rubbed the wrong way when he couldn't hold it all together down the stretch of Valhalla last summer, where I think he really believed he had the PGA Championship in hand. And frankly, he did. He could have beaten, and probably should have beaten, Phil Mickelson. Obviously got in a runner-up situation. But and then you have Rory McIlroy just basically barnstorming the course from behind, albeit, you know, toward the end there and in the final group. But I think Fowler really took a lot from that loss, more than the other three last year, because you have to remember, he was in the top five in all four majors last year, became only the third guy in major championship history to do that. Nicklaus and Tiger Woods have done those accomplishments multiple times each, but they've done it winning a major each time, so in that season. So that really, I think, is a weird distinction. Yeah, I finished in the top five in all four, but I didn't win a damn one of them, so what good did that do? And I think for people who may be among the types who think Ricky Fowler is overrated, if you do, you're a dumbass. But if you thought Ricky Fowler was overrated, then you use that as ammo saying, well, he couldn't seal the deal, and you know, if you finish top five, you should win one of them, right? And that's totally errant thinking. And then on the other side, if you're a Fowler supporter, you go, well, he's trending in the right direction, which he was. In the last year, he's had a scoring average on the PGA Tour somewhere around 70, you know, 69 and change. So you're basically guaranteed 2 to 3 under par every round, which that's why he finishes so well in these major championships. And that was, what, T12 in the Masters, and that was like, oh, well, that's a letdown compared to last year. No, no, that's not how this works. And I think this win's going to mean a whole lot for him moving forward. I would not be shocked if we get an epic U.S. Open out of all of this, because Rory McIlroy is a good putting stroke away, confident putting stroke away from blowing fields away every week. I mean, he finished top eight here and did it without his best stuff, did it pretty much in his sleep because he wasn't really all that interested. I don't think he found the tournament all that intriguing. And then you get into a situation with Jordan Spieth's caddy, Michael Greller, being a former caddy at Chambers, although they've changed the course since probably Greller was a caddy there, and they've also changed it since Jordan Spieth played there in the 2010 U.S. Amateur. But there's some local knowledge there that's just going to work in their favor. And now you've got Fowler, whose game really does travel pretty much anywhere, and he's got a ton of confidence, every reason to believe he can win a major championship. He won the closest thing to it without getting one. So I think we're setting ourselves up for a fantastic U.S. Open. And then on top of all of that, you've got Phil Mickelson, who decides to show up only apparently in the major championships anymore, looking for a U.S. Open after a bazillion second-place finishes, hoping that maybe on this venue, the first time, he gets it right in the U.S. Open and can walk away with a career Grand Slam and feel like he accomplished everything maybe he was destined to do. And that is just wonderful news for the U.S. Open. And the folks at Fox Sports have to be really happy about this, because they've got an Open that a lot of people are going to be interested in. The ratings held up for the players with Fowler in there. I think a lot of people want to see Ricky Fowler do well. They obviously want to see Jordan Spieth do well. They're two young American kids. They're both likable in very different ways. They both take very different approaches to golf. And you've got McIlroy, who's going to probably wind up being the best golfer of this next generation, but he's already got a head start on these guys. He's 26 years old and has four major titles. Fowler's the same age, has zero, but has a ton of top fives now, obviously, in the majors. And then you've got Spieth with his major now turning 22, but he just needs tutelage, needs years, needs maturity. So, great stuff for Fox Sports. They did their first couple of broadcasts. They're actually in the middle of one right now with the U.S. Women's Amateur Four Ball Championship, the first one. They did the men's version of it at the Olympic Club last week. And there were some snafus. They didn't actually show the entire final match live because they had technical difficulties, so they had to show it in tape delay, and that was kind of bad because the result had gotten out there, and everyone bitches and moans when things that are supposed to be live don't turn out to be live, and there's a tape delay and all that stuff. People hate tape delays in the age of Twitter, where you can get the results whenever you want from someone who's either on the ground or who already knows it in terms of the media world. But they're going to get better. The Fox Sports folks are going to get better. I know that they take a lot of pride in what they're doing, and they're going to get it right, at least as right as they can. There's a feeling out period here, because it's a weird relationship for Fox Sports and the USGA, because they air so many tournaments a year. They're obviously going to air the four balls, the amateur, the three opens, and they'll probably do, I assume they're going to do the Walker Cup. So with all, they've got all of those there, but that's really not enough to have a full-time crew, especially because you have a mix of men's and women's events. And frankly, I think it's just wrong for men to call women's events that typically call men's events and really don't do the proper research, and they don't keep a proper awareness of women's golf and what's happening in that part of the game, where it just kind of comes across as bad on TV. So they're doing the right thing, creating crews that can work men's events and women's events. There's some crossover there where there should be. And you're hiring people who are basically going to work 7 weeks of the year max. I think in that regard, you're going to have a hard time getting a really good crew, because there's a lack of consistency there. For the folks who are at ESPN, who do the Open Championship and the Senior Open, the Women's British Open, they obviously only do the three events per year for the Open Championship stuff, but at least they also have the Masters to work with. They have done the Ryder Cup recently, although they don't have the rights to that anymore. They swapped out the last one for some other stuff with NBC Sports. But all of those folks who have been plugged into the ESPN telecasts have done golf extensively in the past in some way. Or they do it in a way where it's not challenging for them because we got the full support of a 30-year network in ESPN that has tons of money, is willing to put in the effort to get these guys up to snuff and make them really good at what they do, or make them sound good at least. So that all comes across as a really good presentation. Fox Sports says they'll take some cues from ESPN. They've also got an extremely inexperienced and young crew, not on the production end, but in terms of in front of the camera. And then you've got your Joe Buck and Greg Norman team leading the way, at least in men's events. Very green in terms of golf broadcasting. Obviously, Norman knows golf as well as anybody. But Joe Buck is very green to golf. He's going to be really, he's going to rub a lot of people the wrong way the first couple of years until he gets into something that works for golfers, or they're just going to grow to deal with his voice, one or the other. But it'll be interesting to see how all of this momentum from the Players' Championship, and we'll get a little bit more with Quail Hollow this week and the Memorial, two very good tournaments leading into the U.S. Open. And then you've got Memphis, which is always a pretty solid event. We're going to see what that really turns into for Fox, and if they can turn that into ratings and drive their muscle a little bit into this and drive value. I mean, they're paying $93 million a year to the USGA for the next 12 years for the right to air all of these events on Fox and Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports 2. And some of you don't even get Fox Sports 1. Many of you will not get Fox Sports 2. You certainly won't get it in HD. So it's going to take a while. Have some patience. It's going to be interesting. I wanted to talk briefly about the anonymous survey crap that's going on, and really what was a driver of the narrative over the weekend, at least as it relates to Ricky Fowler, and really going into the tournament was a driver of narrative, because there was this survey that Golf.com had put together, anonymous, for an anonymous survey of players. And they've done this before. I mean, they've done this for several years. This isn't like, hey, we just decided to do this year. This is something they've done for years, where they, over the course of a period of time, usually 2 to 3 events, they have someone, and they've had Stephanie Way do this in the past. They've had other junior writers for them that aren't necessarily stringers do that. I think that having these anonymous surveys has some value, but they don't have value when it means implicating other players. So, you know, a lot of the questions in the survey were designed to be controversial, and by giving the respondents cover being anonymous, it allows them to say what they really think without potentially hearing back about it from the peer or peers involved. So they asked them, do you think Dustin Johnson took a leave of absence or did he get suspended? And, you know, 70% said, or something to the effect of that, said, well, he was probably suspended, or it was get out or stay out kind of thing. You had questions, obviously, about the overrated players. So you had Ricky Fowler and Ian Poulter, guys who are 13 years apart and just so happen to be faces of a company, or had been faces of a company, in Poulter's case, of Cobra, very loud in-your-face company, as overrated. And then you've got another in-your-face guy in Bubba Watson, who came in third place somehow despite winning 2 Masters titles, as overrated. And you've got questions about, will Tiger Woods win another major? Yes or no? Will he get to 19? Yes or no? All of these things. There's value here for the publication in doing these surveys, because Golf.com can toot their own horn and go, well, as Golf.com reports and self-reference, as they've done on several stories already this year, that must be their new thing. But, you know, self-referencing and then trying to go, well, as we reported, so-and-so percentage of players said blah, blah, blah is blah, blah, blah. And it allows them to keep driving it home as a promotional tool. In that aspect of it, I don't find really acceptable. I hate the notion of that. I hate self-referential reporting, especially as several times this year they've kind of screwed the pooch in terms of messaging what the actual story was or what the actual truth was. And they go, as we reported, well, we clarified that because of this. That's embarrassing. But the value beyond the publication is just drumming up talk. Is, oh, did you read that survey where Ricky Fowler's overrated? Well, you know, this is something I've been thinking about more and more the last few weeks, really, maybe month or two. But I think what we forget so often as sports fans or people that cover the sport, unless you deal with these guys day in and day out, which, you know, unfortunately and fortunately, I don't. But we forget that sports stars, athletes, celebrities, whatever, they're people. At the end of it all, they're people. And people do dumb, weird, stupid, inexplicable things. That's why Jean Vandeveld hit the ball in the burn. That's why Bill Haas pulled off the shot out of the hazard. That's why Tiger Woods slept with all those women. That's why he broke down his swing several times when he was at the top of his game. That's why Rory McIlroy broke up with Caroline Wozniacki the week before the European Tour's flagship event and then won it. They're people. People do weird stuff. You know the weird stuff that you do. I know the weird stuff that I do. The reasons that you do things don't always make sense to other people, but they do to you in the moment. That is true for everybody. Athletes and celebrities are in no way immune from that. And I think that aspect of it is really, it's just something to keep in mind when we think about responses to surveys, when we think about why people do certain things. They have motivations that are so deep-seated in where they came from and where they're at in life, what they're doing. It impacts the decisions they make on and off the golf course. It impacts whether they choose to respond to an anonymous survey or not, why they think Ricky Fowler is overrated, or why they think so-and-so is underrated, or any of those kinds of answers. It's because we're people. And I think if you redid the survey, knowing the results, knowing what Fowler accomplished, he'd come in like 20th, because I'm like, that guy won, you know, he's great. So that's why I don't take a whole lot of value in these types of things, because they're a snapshot of a moment in time, at a person's day, how they're feeling about something. I mean, maybe someone saw a Cobra ad or a print ad was like, that guy's in one lately, I should be in the ad. Because obviously if you're on the PGA Tour, you have to have at least a little bit of an ego to believe you're good enough to hang out with 150 to 200 of the best players in the world. You got to believe you're good enough to win and hang out there. So, you know, answering that question comes from a lot of different places. But I think that two things can be taken from this entire experience of having the survey come out and then having Ricky Fowler win. One, hopefully it means there'll be less of these surveys, because it's really an opportunity for rank-and-file players, which are, they're obviously more rank-and-file players than star players, but for rank-and-file players to share their opinions on things without it getting directly back to a top player that they said it. It's really what this is. And it creates an opportunity to gab, to gossip about things in an irresponsible way. So hopefully that stops. Second, I think hopefully this will give us an opportunity as golf fans to understand the psychology of PGA Tour players and why they think someone may be considered good or bad, overrated, underrated, a good guy, a bad guy. Because Ricky Fowler and Ian Poulter could not be different people. Poulter is brash and in your face. He is outwardly very arrogant, and that's not to say Ricky Fowler isn't arrogant or confident or egotistical, but he's also very respectful, nice guy, does things for people, but he also does things that I'm sure would leave other people scratching their heads or wondering why he did that, stuff like that. So I'm very confused how their peers arrived at a similar, equal conclusion for those two players. It just, again, it only reaffirms my theory that people forget that athletes are human. And you got to just keep that in mind whenever you watch sports. It will make it so much more entertaining to you, because it adds another element to it. Because when Fowler's standing in the fairway thinking about his second shot to 16, going, well, this could be the golf tournament right here. I've got to stick it close. It's not that simple. And you know it because you probably play golf. If you get to a 2-under par start through the first four holes and you're a 10 handicap, what thought occurs to you on the fifth tee? And maybe today's the day. Maybe I could do it. To the right, splash, it's over. Because all of a sudden you remembered your 10 handicap. Mind games play. You're a person. You think about these things. You maybe get a little ahead of yourself sometimes. Or maybe you last five more holes under par because you don't let yourself think about it. You have that kind of mental toughness. Or maybe you've got $20 on the line, so you stick with it. I mean, the thoughts that go through your mind other than just simply executing are really what make golf so fascinating. And I think we tend to forget that about our athletes, where we're just thinking, he's just trying to figure out what the number is and he's going to blast it there. Well, if you saw what his girlfriend was wearing, which he probably saw before the round, he's like, he probably thought about that for a second or two and what could happen if he won and how great his night's going to be if he wins and what this could mean for his career. He probably let that slip into his mind for at least a half second before he said, all right, hitting the metal wood, we're going for it. We're gonna try and make eagle. It has to. It has to go in your head. It may not play out that way as something that you can easily express in the moment where you go, well, yeah, that's what I was thinking about. But we also have the ability and the tendency as we go back and revisit situations to remember what was really weighing on our mind when those things happened. And I think that will probably tell you a lot about how someone thrives or not. Not their golf skill. At this level, the PGA Tour, more than ever, guys 1 through 115 on any given week can win. They can't. It's just the way it is. So, it's not talent level. It's not execution. These guys may do things differently. High ball, low ball, draw, fade, whatever your skill set's better at. Tee ball, approach, ball striking, wedge game, sand play, putting, whatever. All skill sets, but eventually it kind of comes to the mean. So the difference then is where you're at in your head in the moment when it's got to work. And I would think the converse probably happened to Sergio Garcia, standing in the playoff going, how did I even get here? First of all, I usually get screwed out of this kind of stuff because he has that defeatist attitude. And how am I going to beat the guy that just played the last six holes and six under par? And Can I do this again? Am I good enough? I mean, what does that mean to me if I won a Players again because I've won a major? So do I now have the equivalent of a major? Do I have slightly more than one if I win, get ahead of myself a little bit, and all of a sudden I'm a stroke short and I'm out of it? Oh, but I still get $900,000? Oh, well, great. Thank you very much. We'll see you later. So think about that. I just implore you to think about that as you watch sports, and I think you'll find it so much more intriguing. And hopefully, this means for Fowler, the next time that he is in this situation, he doesn't think about the PGA Championship, he thinks about the Players Championship, and that gives him an opportunity to hoist more trophies and hopefully a major trophy, because the sport needs a guy like him. People seem to really flock to him. He's a good guy, and I think the future of the sport is awfully bright if the likes of Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler find themselves top leaderboard more often than not. That'll do it for us this week on the show. Next week on the show, we'll talk a little bit about the Wells Fargo Championship, figure out if Rory McIlroy can win 2 out of 3, doing so at Quail Hollow, the host of the 2017 PGA Championship. Hopefully we'll come up with a guest for you. We've really enjoyed having them on the last few weeks as we've gone through the Masters and even leading into it and since. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Follow me on Twitter, @RyanBallingy. Make sure to leave us a 5-star review. And if you have a question for the show, in the review, leave us your question. We'll be sure to answer it on air as we roll through these reviews and roll through the shows. Until next time, I'm Ryan Ballingy saying thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.